What's up, family? I have a wonderful conversation in store for you today as I spoke with the creatively gifted brother, Roderick Scott. Roderick is a Sacramento, California native and is currently the Vice President of Marketing Strategy at Republic Records. Roderick has worked with some of the biggest artists in the industry, such as Lil Wayne, Kid Cudi, Cordae, 2 Chainz, and Jason Derulo. We talked about how he prepares to create his best work, how getting laid off turned out to be one of the best things for his career, some of his music marketing principles, and so much more. As always, I learned so much in this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. So sit back, relax, and vibe with us on this episode of Dr. J's Office Hours. What's going on, brother? How are you?
I can't complain. Every day above ground is a good one.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for spending time with me and taking the time out your busy schedule to rock with me today.
No worries, man. I'm looking forward to this.
So one of the great aspects of my office hours is that our listeners get a chance to understand the behind the scenes of the amazing work of our guests. So I'd like to start our conversation with asking you, how do you get into your creative zone to produce your best work?
It's a good question. I mean, I think each morning I try to see or get a sense of what the day is going to, you know, have ahead of me. So definitely like watching the news, right? I think for that, it's really just about context, right? Like, it makes no sense to get ready to launch a song or a single in the backdrop of all kinds of other things going on in the world. And I think that comes from being a former publicist too, and just making sure like pitches don't fall on deaf ears, or you're not being ignorant to like larger things that are going on, right? So just being really aware of the room essentially, right? Before I decide to insert whatever it is I'm, you know, personally or professionally like working on. So definitely love getting a chance to kind of just recap what's happened, you know, over the course of the night, or, you know, what are the leading conversations into the day. You know, I've recently gotten into coffee. I think it's just more, especially with the kid, just having a little bit of extra like juice, you know what I mean, to kind of start the morning off. So that's been helpful, especially if it's been like a late night or, you know, dealing with the little one. But yeah, pretty, I think just really getting ahead of what the conversation of the day is, really getting into those water cooler conversations, if you will, and then, you know, maybe having like an energy boost where needed.
What's your coffee of choice? What do you go with? Are you a mocha, you know, cappuccino? What's your vibe?
I just do it black, you know, and I might add in some like, you know, slight little bit of like, you know, milk, whether it's almond milk or something. And then maybe, you know, I try not to do too much like sugar, you know, additional. Just trying to be cognizant, especially if I'm not going to be working out like I used to, whatever. You know what I mean? Cutting back, denying myself.
Right.
Indulgences.
I can't hang with you on the black coffee, man. That's strong. That's some real tough taste bud you got, man.
Oh man, it's definitely bean water, but you know, hey.
So from there, I'd like to ask you, as you reflect back on your life and your career, what would you say is a defining moment that you believe led you to where you are today?
Oh man. I would actually have to say being laid off, you know, like it was unexpected. It was something that I didn't really, you know, not necessarily warranted either. It's just sometimes, you know, it's musical chairs, right? And, you know, I'd been 8 years into this job. So I had survived several different, I think this is about third, fourth round of layoffs until, you know, my number was eventually called. But, you know, just being in that position of like, you know, what am I going to do? Not necessarily stressing. Severance, you know, I had a good severance package just from the time from being there, but really making a calculated decision on what I want for me next and kind of being still in that process and allowing, you know, the right one to come to me versus the right now. So I would say that was definitely kind of a situation that, you know, I think it ended up paying out for the better, just in the sense because, you know, if you once you stay at a place for so long, I think unfortunately sometimes it's like they see you for who you were versus who you are, you know what I mean?
Right,
and so I think they got used to seeing, you know, this kid came as an assistant and blah, blah, blah. I needed some place, I think, that kind of had a fresh set of eyes and experience on me. And so that led to a great opportunity moving out to New York. And I think, you know, transitioning out of the publicity world into the more marketing what I'm doing now.
And so can we, I want to zero in a little bit on something you said. You said, you know, what do I want for me? And I think, you know, that's a question that I don't think is often asked when you're in a position where you feel like you have to survive, meaning you get laid off or you get fired or you lose your job or the company shuts down or whatever the case may be, right? We're trying to get to the next thing, to get to the next check or to pay those bills or whatever the case. But you said, what do I want for me? And I feel like that frames the decisions in the position you put yourself in the future. Could you tell me a little bit more about that thought process of what you wanted for yourself versus what you felt you had to do in order to get to that next step?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, it was a colleague of mine had once said, you know, Raj, you got to be the CEO of your own career, right? Like You, at end of the day, regardless what happens, if I were to go, they're going to refill my position in the next 6 months, if you will, right? So it's like really making sure that before you dive into anything, especially new, being kind of selfish, right? Looking out for yourself for it. I mean, the worst people can say is no. I think that's something I had to learn, you know, longer or, you know, as I further advanced in my career, but going in high, right? And then knowing my wealth, or, you know, what I perceive to be as my wealth, and then allowing whatever, you know, their constraints are to match that versus kind of me going in to fit what they have going on. You know what I mean? So I kind of changed it into perspective and just being like, look, you know, in the day you are, you know, employing me or hiring me, however you want to call it, for what I bring to the table, like my entire self. And so I got to put a premium on that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, overtaxing people. I was about to use a Jay-Z line, but let me not do that right now. That show just may go to. So, but yeah, no, again, just really understanding wealth, like what you offer, what you bring to the table, your perspective, you know what I mean? And just like really being more confident about that. And if it's not for you, it's not for you. You know what I mean? And not being afraid to walk away from a situation that doesn't recognize that same type of value you have, but also being realistic too, right? Like, I have to know where I'm at realistically at market value, but also in addition to like what maybe may not be, you know, a marketable like trade, if you will, right? There's still experience. There's, again, perspective that, you know, ourselves bring, you know, to certain places and positions. And so, you know, not sacrificing any of that to fit into a particular model, you know?
Yeah. And how would you say, you know, a lot of our listeners are, you know, young professionals and college students. And, you know, the question that I get asked a lot is, you know, what about this concept of knowing your worth and your value? Because right, when you're first beginning, particularly in the Black and Brown community, you tend to devalue yourself, meaning like you'll take that, you know, that 30-40K a year job because you just started out. Meanwhile, your actual value and your gifts and your talent is worth 75-80, but because you just came out of college or you're just a year or two in, you feel like you can't get those. Like, how do you sort of parse out, you know, overconfidence and not being realistic versus understanding the value that you bring to a particular a job or skill set?
Yeah, I think the first thing is self-awareness, right? And, I love some of the idealism when it comes out of college and like, oh, I can change the world. But you have to realistically understand where you are, where you reside within this world, right? Like, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, I went to said school and I've studied in this and blah, blah, blah. But like, what actual work experience are you bringing to a position? And not just, oh, well, I type well, I'm great at administrative work, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going in for that 75K, I think really looking at what the job entails, and if you're asking for a salary cap that doesn't match the description for it, again, a little self-awareness to yourself would say, hey, this may not necessarily be there for, right? I think, again, you can go in a little bit higher for it. I mean, again, 30K, it's rough, but I mean, just for comparison, when I first started, one of my first jobs into the industry was at 28K with overtime, right? But I knew overtime would help kind of compensate for some, that lack of, you know, a salary, which, you know, honestly is sustainable, but knowing that that would help kind of like supplement there, but also too, right, that was put more battery in my back to figure out what either side hustles that I could do, if there are other ways that I could extend myself outside of this. But, you know, being entertainment in general, like there's a lot of competition of people trying to get into these positions and who will take less and less for certain roles. So you got to be cognizant of that, right? Like if it's something that you really and truly want, there may have to be some sacrifices, you know, in order to get the things that you eventually want. But don't outprice yourself as well, right? Like, it's one thing to go on and say, hey, I think I'm worth this much, but you've really got to put that into real assessment. And if you don't have the work experience, you don't necessarily have or haven't brought anything like new to the table that this company is going to be opting into their strategy or whatever. You know, I think it takes a little bit of a humble pie, but just knowing that as long as you're making gains, you're meeting the right people, like that kind of experience, I think is invaluable, you know?
Yeah, now that's a good point. And so, you know, being the position that you hold, which I want to get into in a minute, when we talk about talent and gifts and this idea of a lack of experience, when you are, you know, a VP or someone in a leadership role looking at the next generation of talent, fresh talent, right? How do you sort of identify whether or not this young or this individual is bringing something new to the table that is worth, you know, more than, say, an entry-level job? For example, it's hard to teach culture, right? Like, sometimes you just, there's just this innate gift that somebody will have. How do you actually sort of make that tangible to someone like yourself in a leadership role? Do they present some sort of portfolio? How would you be able to identify that for someone who's just like, I got the talent, I don't got the experience, but I know I got this?
Yeah, I think it's the portfolio, right? And I know sometimes that if you don't have necessary like experience that is directly, you know, applicable to the job you're looking for, what else are you doing to try to help to realize this dream, this goal that you have in mind, right? Like, if it's just kind of waiting around for an opportunity to open up and, oh, I haven't gotten one yet, so I don't have experience, it's kind of like, I don't know, right? You know, again, for myself, I was the kid that had 4 different internships at the same time, or, you know, within the same year, different places, just volunteering out where I could, even if it was just like event type work, right? So I knew that, you know, meeting various people that, hey, they might need an extra set of hands for this event, whatever, that they're putting together for a showcase or an artist or something, right? Like, again, not paid, I have to show up on myself, you know, probably having to buy an outfit or something just to actually be there and help myself and lend out. But I knew that would pay off, and just in the connections that I'd be able to make, and also just showing up and letting people see that just because I, you know, I'm not getting paid or whatever, I'm still volunteering your time. And your time is also very, you know, important. It's also valuable as well. So people can see that and like, all right, the person is still showing up, not really asking for much, but just an opportunity to kind of just be around and kind of get their feet wet and stuff. I think having that kind of like hustler like mentality, I think definitely stands out. I think, you know, again, having the deck situation, I think having a sense of like just case studies, you know what I mean? Whether or not of learnings and things that they've kind of taken apart and showing that they have real, I think, technical knowledge of something, and just maybe what they might reveal as opportunities to help like optimize, you know, whether it's campaigns that are going on or just general ideas and things that weren't necessarily considered in a rollout. Those are good things to bring to the table and great discussion points, especially talking to somebody, you know, who, unfortunately, you know, I'm sometimes flying at 60,000 feet or, you know, 30,000 feet trying to figure out stuff. I'm not necessarily in the weeds of things all the time, but having something closer to the source, again, just kind of showing up to things and providing their unique insight as like that target audience, you know what I mean? I think that can help in kind of overcoming some of those like skill deficits, if you will, or experience deficits.
Yeah, yeah. And so help me understand a little bit more about what you actually do day to day in your role.
Sure. So basically, I'm the manager in-house, right? I think that's probably the easiest way to discuss it. You know, so I lead the marketing campaigns for artists. I think more importantly, you know, I don't really do anything with the recording side, right? I think my job starts once the music is done, it's turned in, and it's now, what do we do with this? What's the plan? How do we get it out there to people? In the day, marketing is making an emotional connection with people, particularly fans and also, you know, partners that you're dealing with. So what am I doing to help amplify what this artist is doing while keeping it intact with their vision? So it's everything from creating assets, you know, whether it's the motion graphics or the artwork, the shooting the videos, right? How many videos do we decide to shoot for this? At what budget, at what scale? What does a digital plan look like? Who's the publicist that's going to be on this thing? What are our targets and our goals for each of these sectors? Is this a song that should go to radio or not? You know, does this song have brand or sync potential? Really carving that out really early, and then, you know, galvanizing the internal team to kind of see this vision and, you know, start working them. Because, you know, a lot of the times, a lot of my counterparts within the company, don't necessarily work all my projects. They're working other projects and various projects, and I think maybe within the genre that I'm working, right? So I have to kind of find a way to get them to the front of the line or consideration based upon what we have, what we're building, and then where we're trying to go. So the easiest thing, I guess, if I'm gonna use a sports analogy, is kind of like a quarterback of a team, right? You know, the ball is the artist or like the vision. We're trying to move it down the field, and I'm using the team to kind of help us get out that way. So my sales team will like be like my offensive line. My publicist might be my wide receiver. My digital marketer is probably like my fullback or my running back, right? Like, and I'm getting calls, or the plays are being called by the coaches, which could be, you know, the managers, or it could be even sometimes the executive management team within the company. But I'm at the liberty to call an audible based upon what I'm seeing the defense is doing and what the nature of the play is. So really, again, it's about just moving the what I can down the field. And hopefully, you know, the touchdown is essentially just making sure our goals are met. Whatever the goals that we decide at the beginning of the campaign. And not all goals are the same, right? Like someone could, like, I want to be the biggest pop star in the world. Okay, that's a great long-term goal, but how do we get to there? You know what I mean? So really narrowing down what are our short-term steps in order to get to that point, whatever. But also, again, realizing that I don't control culture. And I think that's one thing as a marketer, and I think I learned as being just a publicist, right? Like, in the day, you can be the most talented. You can make the greatest project in the world. Sometimes timing is what it's at. If the culture is not at a space where they're willing to accept or hear or engage the way you think they are, sometimes that's just kind of the nature. That's par for the course.
So could you give me sort of a 30,000 foot perspective of a campaign that you worked on from inception to completion, to kind of give our listeners a better understanding of like what you actually mean by being a you know, a quarterback of a team? Because I thought that was a great analogy to use sports. But say, you know, an artist that you worked with, an album drops, they finish it up, it's packaged, it's ready to go. Now what? Now what are you doing? What would be an example of a campaign that you worked on where you sort of walk us through that process?
Yeah, so I guess I'll just start the process in general, right? Like the A&R turns in the music. Mm-hmm. It's all cleared. I have to make sure everything is cleared first, because legally we can't touch records that aren't necessary. I'm not putting dollars behind something that will never be able to come out to market or the legal ramifications if it does, right? Mm-hmm. So making sure that's all buttoned up, ironed out, we get legal's blessing to move forward from there. And then having that come to Jesus with the artist, right? Like, who are you? What do you want from this? You know, where do you see yourself in comparison to the other artists that are within your lane right now? What's going to be our focus single? Is this our focus track, or is this kind of something just to get things going, heat up the algorithms, if you will? You know, get your monthly users and listeners up ahead of you dropping like your official single or a larger project. And then from there, you know, what kind of budget tolerance? And again, it could be based upon what their deal is, or just, you know, if they have that flexibility to where they're not limited to that kind of stuff. How much are you willing to shell out in order to kind of help accomplish this stuff? And that helps just really on the budget and the fiduciary side of things, figuring out how much I have to work with as far as creating videos, creating assets. Does this make sense to do a tour? Does this make sense to do an event? Is there a showcase that should be done? But really understanding who the artist is, what their lane is going to be, what those fans that are, you know, what they currently have, but also the fans they're trying to target next. You know, how are we going to talk to and address these people? How do we find our early adopters and folks that can galvanize for us? Do we need cosigns going to this, or is this kind of a song or a project or a fan base that doesn't really care about that kind of stuff, right? Like, it's more boots on the grounds, and it's that word of mouth stuff versus having like, you know, a press outlet or a radio partner coming and being like, this person's the next step. You know what I mean? So all that you figure out really early. And then at that point, it's just now planning and executing that kind of stuff. So either whether I talk to my specialist, who I mentioned on my internal SWAT team, which of course is my digital marketer, my publicist, my sales or my commerce rep, you know, my ancillary people who could be, you know, my radio team or my sync team, my brands team. You know, there's like a content partnership team too that we also deal with too. But who am I engaging? When am I engaging? And is the right time to do so for it? And then once I think you figure all that out, it's just at that point, you know, starting to sequence and, you know, figuring out what the timeline is going to be to really impacting some of these things that I've helped to create, or at least these partnerships that we had kind of locked in to, you know, where do I inject these things within the course or the timeline of when this promotional campaign is going to start. So I'm trying to think of a project that I could think of. I guess it can go back to, I'm going to say Cordae is the Lost Boy, right? Like, we had a really really good idea of kind of where he was in comparison to some of his counterparts in this movement that he had come up with, but realizing that he had a very unique type of perspective that wasn't necessarily being displayed within the current setting that he was at, and using this as like his statement piece, like his mission objective on just kind of who he is. And, you know, I think playing around with the idea of the Lost Boy, just not knowing necessarily who he was at this point in time, right? Like, mm-hmm. and kind of the path to success or in general has many, you know, twists and turns. It's not necessarily a linear type path from there. And so, you know, I think luckily for him, you know, my job was easier because the music was just great. He had the sequencing and everything all figured out from there. It was now just how do we create tools and storylines to kind of help sell this thing through, to make it make sense to people. We identify him just knowing that, again, that he had such a great, you know, command of his craft that it's something that, you know, the old guard would also find interesting in comparison. So what the new guard does as well, getting some of those crucial cosigns from some of those earlier, like, gatekeepers, quote unquote, if you will, mm-hmm. To help us prep us up and just being like, hey, this is the kid to really take serious. Don't necessarily like assume that just because he rolls with X, Y, and Z, that he doesn't necessarily have something to say from there, whatever. So
yeah.
That was important. Again, having really smart and dope visuals, locking in a particular director or production company and having them do the bulk of the project, right? Instead of necessarily going out to different directors and different projects for each single, we wanted to create a cohesive visual narrative for each song that we put out, right? A similar taste and tone and temperature in the visuals and the corresponding content that we would have to kind of support this thing. So I think really for this one, it was about not necessarily doing a hodgepodge and jumping in to see what was, you know, going to come next and leaning into opportunities. It was more about like, let's create the world, let's bring people into this world, and then from there the plans and the things that come out, the partnerships, the opportunities are all tied into like a shared and collective vision behind you know, how you're going to get this thing out to people.
I was watching Insecure. Actually, I was actually watching Insecure last night. Like, you know, I'm way behind. I like to keep up with Issa's work. But anyway, there was this episode played by the brother from Queen Sugar. His name escapes me right now. The brother, dark skinned brother with the beard, and he was playing. Mm-hmm. His character was Crenshaw, which was an artist, right?
Yep.
And mm-hmm. and he was asked to perform, you know, at this event. And the management team wanted him to perform a certain way, but he felt that his vision, he believed in himself so much that he felt that he didn't want to compromise his vision for this particular management team. How does that actually translate into the real world? Does things like that actually happen where, you know, a concert's about to happen or a show or some sort of live experience and you're saying, okay, guys, like, this is how it needs to be rolled out, this is how it needs to be executed, and then the artist pulls an audible. How does that translate into the real world? Is that just for TV, or do things like that and moments like that actually happen?
Things do happen like that. I hope that we try to have that addressed prior to showtime. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Or the point of execution, right? Like really ironing out all the details. I think it's really important to really manage expectations, not just for the brands and teams you're dealing with, but also with the artists, right? Mm-hmm. Really explaining them what the opportunity entails, telling them maybe who the audience is going to be there, telling them, again, what our goal is for doing this type of thing. And again, and I'm never going to start going to press an artist to do what they don't want to do, right? I present a suite of options and things that are available in case they want to take advantage of. And it's up to the manager and the artist to understand, to see that, weigh all of the, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of that, the opportunities from that, if it makes sense for them, and if whether or not they want to execute it. And, you know, making sure they truly understand what it is, what the value is of it, so that, you know, when it's time to actually show up, there's not these questions or this, oh, now I'm setting cold feet on wanting to do this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And giving them plenty of time to actually do so, right? Like, you know, I know things can happen all the time. Artists are mercurial. You know, that's what it is to be a creative, right? So they have a particular vision, but sometimes it's about how do you mold your vision to fit the existing promotional channels for something like this, right? And sometimes, you know, some of these events, they have a specific what they want out of the creative that's going to be there. A lot of the times too, the creative or which is, you know, maybe a brand is putting on something. It's secondary to what they actually need for the event. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes the talent part of it is just to kind of keep people happy and excited, but there's other things going on, and the true nature of the event or this thing that they're throwing or this partnership or this this campaign they're putting together. So, you know, letting artists know sometimes too, like, you may just be, you know, I hate to say it, but like an accoutrement or something, right? Like, you could just be a, to help, you're another part of this event versus being the sole part of that, right? I think you just take it, you know, you have to really know who your artists and your management team are to see how receptive they'll be to something like that. Some people get it, others people don't, and you know, sometimes this may not be the right opportunity for you, you know what I mean? But yeah. I think really just, again, managing the expectations really early and along the way, making sure any question they have is, you know, answered and, you know, truly like taken to heart for it. And then again, allowing them to kind of make the decision whether or not it feels right for them. So yeah. There's a lot of vetting on our side before we try to put them into those situations, because we don't want them to be like uncomfortable. But again, once you have that, it's just about making sure both sides really understand what's being asked of them. And then again, what is the goal of doing something like this?
Right. And you mentioned earlier that you're not necessarily a part of the recording process. It's after they record, that's when you sort of take the baton and move forward. But how yep. do you actually develop a relationship with the artist when the project is already done? Like, what's the sort of the timeline for that? Are you having conversations as that artist is recording, just kind of getting to know them? Like, say you don't know Cordae from a hole in the wall, right? You guys meet yep. for the first time. What's that process like for you to feel comfortable and moving forward with his project, understanding the full holistic artist?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially going back to that conversation we were saying about like what the come to Jesus is, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's cool. Like, you have this project, you have this song you're working on. You know, I like to get a little bit involved if I can't earlier, just helping with like content and making assets and stuff. And the creation of those albums is a gold mine of some of those contents, really understanding their perspective, what it's taking from them in order to make this project or make this single. Like, that's the backstory, the interesting stuff, the narrative that we were discussing. You can really find that that's gold in that creation like type moment, whatever, too. Some artists necessarily can't do that. They just want to focus on creating and they don't have to worry about like how to sell it to people. But at the end of the day, like, you know, this is the music business. This is not music just for art, right? Like, if mm-hmm. it was, cool, put it out there. But in the day, you want a return on investment. The people you have a partnership with want a return of their investment. And so my job is to come in is to how do we help amplify what you're doing? How do you know, what are our actual goals? And I think that come to Jesus part, right? It's just like, what are we trying to do here? You know what I mean? Like, what does this mean to you? What is this supposed to mean to fans? What is it supposed to mean to culture in general when you know, put this out there? End of the day, there's 60,000 songs being uploaded to these streaming platforms a day, right? And let's say if 99% of that is trash, that still leaves you with what, 600 artists or songs that you have to compete with, right? And there just isn't that much time in the day to get through all these things, whether it's a gatekeeper or a person who's controlling kind of like access to some of these like larger marketing or, you know, inventory within like the retail space for these places. So is we have to make it the most compelling argument in order, and also tools and assets and things in a compelling narrative in order to get some of that real estate within some of the, whether it's the streaming platforms or whether it's some of these media outlets, some of the coverage you're trying to do. But, you know, without having a tightly, you know, wound up, how do we do or introduce you in this song to those people? Like, essentially you've been recording just for your own at that point. You know what right. I mean? But any point where you decide, hey, I want to put this out for commerce, whatever, you're now discussing, like, this is not just art for you. It's art for everyone. So right. particularly your fans, right? So how do we package it to a way that they'll receive it? But also, how do we get those fans to be able to evangelize like your music to their networks, right? That word of mouth from there. And so, you know, let's give ourselves the best chance and the best opportunity moving forward versus I want it out right now. And again, I use this phrase and I wish I found out who I got it from, but we could do this right or we can do this right now. At the end of the day, it's up to you and what you want to do for it. So, right. you know, tell us how you want to move and we'll plan a timeline accordingly to it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I can only go off of the thousands of singles and, you know, a couple hundred albums I put out in this like 12-year career that I've done. So you know
know what you're doing. You've been doing it a little bit.
I'm just a little bit. And again, I know all, you know, I'm not saying there's one like blueprint for any particular artist. I truly treat each campaign as individual, because again, it has its own unique sense of like its setting, you know, the timing that it's coming out and just who the artist and their perspective are. But, you know, there is a reason why I'm employed to do this thing. So, right. You know, again, it's up to you. It's your career. It's your vision. It's your baby. I truly understand and respect that. I'm only here to help give you some insight on how to help get it out there and, you know, move it, the ball a little bit further down the field than you have.
Mm-hmm. So. And can you tell me what is this? Because you mentioned the Sync team. What is mm-hmm. the Sync team and why are they important?
So yeah, Sync team, I mean, you know, it's whenever you heard a song in like an advertisement or a commercial, or, you know, I'm watching like the NBA finals, whatever, and like the spots that come on, the interstitials leading into, you know, some of the actual games or the coverage and stuff, right? Like that's a natural lean back moment that you can insert your music into. And if people like it, they'll either pull out a Shazam, you know what I'm saying, and try to figure out what this is, or they may research the lyrics of something or Google, hey, what was the song playing during blah, blah, blah from there, whatever. But at least that shows there's some type of interest from someone who's actively gonna go out there and actively search for you after hearing something. So just another touch point on how to get your music out to fans who might necessarily be part of your ecosystem, but are still, you know, savvy enough listeners that they like something and they like what they hear, they're gonna actively search it out for it. So it's another touch point for us. And those are music supervisors. So whether you're watching Insecure, who does a great job or did a great job of curating sounds that fit the mood and setting up the scene that they were trying to do, that's what the Sync team kind of entails, whatever, or commercials. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're the ones who are pitching for, hey, my artist should fit this. And, you know, it's a whole secret sauce on how certain songs are selected and chosen for those things. Everything from, you know, the song, who the artist is, what the BPM is, what the setting is for the opportunity. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of things go into play before they decide what songs they want to integrate to it. Sometimes a publishing splits, right? Like, there's 50 people on a song. There's no way a brand is going to be able to pay all 50 people the rate they all want in order to use this, you know. So sometimes while you hear, you know, sinking in potential, especially if you're an indie artist, could be real lucrative because, again, it's less red tape to kind of like get through in case you want to go for like one of those larger pop songs that everybody knows about.
Yeah, that's interesting because if you look at like we're closer to the same age, man. Montel Jordan, This Is How We Do It. Like, how many times have you heard that song, whether we were growing up or just even today, right? In commercials.
Exactly.
Is the person that was on that team to release that album, are they involved in that process, or is it now just lawyers at this point because it came out 25, almost 30 years ago?
It's lawyers, but mostly they're publishing. So whoever they're registered to publish with will have like the rights to that song. And so anyone who's looking to get that song can contact the publisher and they can make sure that everything is all buttoned up legally. So, you know, they can get clear uses for that and not have a problem down the line for something. But management, you know, of course, I mean, again, managers, you know, pretty much change. It's hopefully even manager that's with an artist, you know, from inception to the end of the career. But that's just not how kind of like the game usually ends. And, you know, artists end up growing and sometimes outgrowing management, or management outgrows an artist or a client, right? But I would say like your publisher and where your song is registered at, they still know and have a hold of the rights, or at least able to talk to people to get rights, you know, signed off and cleared for use in whatever mode you're thinking.
Got it. And so someone like a DJ Khaled, like, he probably has a ton of red tape because he always has like four or five artists on a lot of his songs.
Yeah, it's going to be expensive to clear a Khaled song, especially if you start going to the individual feature artists. And then again, you know, who are the writers on it? Who are the producers on it, right? Like, if it's a one-stop shop, it's a lot easier, especially for brands and partners who aren't necessarily part of the music space. To be like, oh, this is much easier and less red tape than having to go with something with, you know, multiple collaborators, multiple feature artists, multiple labels sometimes, which are, you know, represented within one piece of audio recording. So, you know, less is more on the Sync side of things, I'll say.
And so you said your background came from sort of being a publicist. How did that role sort of help you usher into where your career is now?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, you know, growing up, leaving out of college, I was actually a communication and media studies major. I was an advertising minor. My first job when I got out of college was actually at an ad agency doing media planning and media buying. So did that until I got a call from a label who was like, hey, we have an opportunity, excuse me, for a publicity publicist role to be an assistant within one of these departments. And so I think the biggest thing from that, it is earned media, right? We don't necessarily have like the biggest budgets in what we're trying to do. A lot of it is favor for favor, right? Like pitching a journalist or pitching a freelancer on a unique opportunity about an artist you're working with in consideration for coverage, whether that will be online, whether that is going to be, you know, in print. That takes, of course, a much longer lead time than it will be for something online. And then in the Holy Grail or some of these TV moments, you know, where you can actually bring an artist's full vision to life with the recording for it. So what helped me with that again was just learning, you know, how to pitch and pitch and pitch and pitch. And, you know, I used to call it professional begging because you're really out here vulnerable, just like, hey, I know you're getting thousands of emails today, but here's my one opportunity to pitch you to see if you might be interested in this artist that I'm working with. And so getting told no, like a lot of times, you know what I'm saying? Like full out rejection. And I would actually encourage the response of, hey, I'm going to pass on this at this time, versus just the pass by not responding to you. I mean, there's people who I emailed probably hundreds of times and hadn't heard anything from until that one time where they're like, yeah, for sure, let's lock this in. So, you know, it was just keep knocking at the door, see what happens from there. But again, also realizing too that I had to have self-awareness about, you know, my artist and like what's happening. Like if there's a, you know, breaking story about, let's say for now, what's happening with Russia and the Ukraine, like does it make sense to try to be like, hey, listen to this rap song today when there's all these other fears and things going on like in the world, and where editorially wise they have to skew things to cover and at least not be, you know, tone deaf to what's happening culturally wise versus this one thing popping off. And so I've had many times actually in my career where, you know, with launches and things, we have to push back based upon what was actually happening within society in general. And so being self-aware, I think it helped out, learning how to pitch, learning how to take rejections and no's. The media planning and buying side on my advertising, like, you know, learning that really helped me prepare how does publishing work in general when it comes to media, right? Like, what are they looking for? What is their key performance indicator, right? And I noticed a shift towards the end part of me in my time doing publicity that it was more about, before it was about, hey, let's cover everything, let's just get as many visitors to the site based upon the breadth of artists that we're covering. Mm-hmm. It switched to now we need users to stay on our site and not bounce off after getting one click and leaving for a certain place. So they stopped necessarily covering as many artists to focus on like the main bigger artists and then doing like the listicles to keep people more engaged on a website to help their website traffic pop up higher in the search results, right? Versus, you know, you end up getting, I don't want to say penalized, but you end up getting suppressed if you don't have people engaging with your site and staying on for a little while. So just seeing the shift happening on the publishing side showed me that, all right, like maybe this time, you know, as a publicist, and particularly a publicist working baby acts, may not be, you know, a long-term like future career option that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. And so what, did you always know that you wanted to get into music, or did music sort of just sort of fall into your lap as you had an interest in marketing? Because I feel like a lot of, you know, our listeners, you know, they're exploring and they're tasting, right? They're young, right? 18, 19, 20, 21. You're trying to sort of find your way. And there are certain like skill sets that you naturally have. And then there's certain skill sets that you develop as you're exploring your interests. What did you have where you felt like, I want to get into, you know, be a publicist or get into marketing or work into music? What was kind of that journey for you?
Yeah, I knew I always wanted to work in music. I mean, I was the kid, you know, grew up with just, my mom was in the choir, had us all in the choir too, whatever, singing. I played saxophone growing up. My brother played piano. You know, we'd break out in like 4 or 5 part harmonies, like driving the car down the road. So music has always just been a part of my life, whatever. You know, grandparents used to sing. My grandmother on my dad's side was also like an organist and pianist at her church, like leading music over there. So
I always knew I wanted to. You couldn't help it.
Yeah. You know, like it was always around, right? And it brought me joy, whatever. You know what I mean? Like even to these days, like hearing melodies and chords, like, especially, you know, someone hitting a good run or something, like, still sends, like, chills. I get goosebumps, you know, when I hear, like, a great, like, harmony or, like, a great melody that's coming out of something. So I always knew I was going to be around music. I just didn't know what form or function of it. At one point, you know, I wanted to be the next Hype Williams, right? Like, I love the visual aspect and how I can kind of tell stories and help amplify stories through great visuals and things. And so,
me too,
right?
Brother, me too. Was it not? If you grew up in the 90s, there's no way you didn't want to be Hype Williams, right? Like,
For sure. Yeah, no, I mean, it's the MTV generation, BET. You know what I'm saying? Like, the height, the 106 and Park age. You know what I'm saying? Like, right, where I was like, all right, like, this is where I need to be. And so I didn't necessarily know what I wanted to do when I got to college. And so I think having, you know, I know communication, people are like, oh, that's just a, it's a broad degree. It is. And especially for folks who don't know necessarily where they want to be at within it. So, you know, I experimented, I was interning at a magazine where I was writing articles for, based upon music, whatever, working at ad jobs, whatever, and some that had music accounts to kind of figure that out, interning on digital marketing teams for labels. And at this time, digital marketing was really just being in chat rooms and on chat boards and just inserting your artists into conversations that were happening there. This was, you know, before Facebook really even took off, like the MySpace type era or whatever, you know what I mean? Like jumping in people's comments or those different community rooms to, you know, amplify your artists or, hey, let's talk about this. And what do you guys think about this type of situation? So I think really just being open to the opportunity. And so, you know, when I got that job offer that came, you know, when I was at the ad agency to say, hey, do you want to, you know, take on this assistant role in the publicity department? You know, I had already been interning at a couple of PR agencies, mostly to do like red carpet stuff, like helping them do set up media rooms, sometimes working with artists and their publicist teams directly, to help them secure interviews and opportunities when they're doing these red carpet or day of show things. I was like, sure, I'm pretty used to that world. And even if I don't want to do this, it's my step into the door. That helped really me figure out, like, even just on the public side, once I got into the label, I got to understand what the different departments of the label do and then where I could see myself in doing something. And so the marketing for me was another the goal, because it's a great spot of being like creative, but also being like strategic, right? And you know, what are we doing to help get to a certain point, whatever. So I could be creative in my decision making, but also have a budget, I think. And sometimes, you know, whereas PR, where I'm depending on other people to help me accomplish my goals, I get more creative. I have more autonomy here to be like, this is what I want to do based upon my conversation with the artists and their dream and their vision. How do we get this thing together? So creativity, a little bit different space.
And so, I hope everyone is taking notes. You have been giving us so many gems. I guess what I'd like to know from you is, as you look back, what are some of the things that the Roderick of today would tell the younger version of yourself? Like, what would you say to yourself coming out of college, what you need to prepare for as you enter this professional space?
Ooh, so when I came out of college, it was right when the recession started. I actually had a job, like a dream job. I was about to do branding and PR for Jordan Brand via this agency that they had. I think I was on the job. I didn't even step into the office. I did one meeting over the phone, was going to go in that following week, and they said, hey, we're actually liquidating this position. And I was just like, oh, damn. You know, and again, I'm from Sacramento. Didn't really have family really out in LA. I had an aunt in like Carson or something, whatever. And I was with my girl at the time and just kind of figure out, like, you know, what do I do from here? And so months of trying to just, you know, luckily I had a campus job, which helped me, gave me like free room and free board, during this summer after the job got, you know, liquefied, whatever. But essentially it was like between, I would say, August when, you know, the next semester started, and that summer job that I had was no longer there. Had to end up moving in with, you know, my girl, who I was probably just with. She's now my wife, but we had only been dating for 3 months at that point in time. So, you know, it was really uncomfortable just being like, hey, so I have two options. I can either go back to Sacramento and this is probably done, or she's like, no, you can just come stay with me. You know what I mean? Until you figure stuff out. And so, what I would say to myself at that point in time, just really see it through, right? You know, take the opportunities that come to you, which I did, but also have an exit strategy for that too, right? I think once I got that publicity job, I think I was just so happy to be at a spot that I was going to just take the different iterations for what it was. But, you know, I ended up being there for 8 years, and, you know, they promoted me, you know, ever so slightly here and there. But at a certain point, it's like, all right, you know, I think it's time to move on to a different situation earlier. I wouldn't have stayed at that job as long as I did, if I was talking to myself now, looking back into it, making more of a lateral move elsewhere to try to get into a new system, versus kind of staying in one place and just hoping they would do right by me while I was there.
And what would be three words of wisdom that you could share with our listeners, for, you know, whether it be life, the position that you're in, the role that you play? What would be some advice that you would give our listeners?
I mean, it's not three words, but this phrase that I keep coming back to, and it's actually a Corday lyric too. It's divine timing took a lot of patience. right? Mm. And I think that is the key to it, right? Like, you know, what's the best way to make God or the universe laugh, right? It's tell him or her your plans. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can do everything that's right and everything by the book, but sometimes it just, you have to wait for time and to wait for the opportunity to actually present itself. And not being discouraged by that. You know what I mean? Like, right. You know, it may not happen like overnight, but I truly believe that like it's a war of attrition. If you keep knocking at that door, if you keep, you know, putting your foot in where you can, keep extending yourself and volunteering or showing up, I think eventually it will come back to you, whatever. You know what I mean? I think you totally get the energy you're putting out there. And again, it could be a year, it could be a couple, but I think staying true to your vision, staying true to what you want, I think eventually the universe opens up to, you know, at least giving you an opportunity to take advantage of exactly where you're trying to go.
Yeah, I mean, there's your plan and there's the plan, right?
Exactly. 100%.
We learn that. Sometimes you learn that the hard way. And I do think that there's this, entitlement's the wrong word, but I just think of, I would say like naivete around, you know, opportunity versus outcomes. Right. Like,
for sure.
You know, we feel like we work hard in a certain aspect of our life and feel like we deserve an outcome when in fact it really only guarantees an opportunity. You know what I mean? Like, and,
for
and
sure,
I think
for
that,
sure.
That's such a hard thing to sort of deal with when you're so passionate and you feel like you've done, like you said, everything right. And it's just not panning out the way you had hoped. So that's some great advice.
Yeah, I thank God that we grew up when we did, and just making sense to, you know, to be able to know what the real world is, and also having this social media like part that you use to kind of help amplify what you're doing. But like at the end of the day, like I think that instant gratification has, you know, kind of been a detriment, unfortunately, to certain people. So I would also say just resist the urge to look around and seeing that what everyone else is doing and comparing yourself to their journeys, right? Everyone's journey is their own particular one. You don't know what it took for that person. I know that's kind of cliche, but you don't have no idea what took them to get to where they are. You don't even know if they're actually happy in that. And while they might be in immediate gain and it looks good from the outside, it might not be sweet. You know, I've seen people who, you know, immediately graduated, got these great jobs and, you know, high salary caps, and ended up hating the job and ended up quitting, you know, a couple of years just because of the burnout or not being, you know, necessarily like passionate about what they're doing. So I think really take stock of your own journey, really have a master plan of where you're trying to go, but also understand, make sure that it's also flexible and it also is able to bend into the insight and the input you're getting from around you.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last question I have for you, what are some of your favorite books that you've read throughout your career or your life where you feel like, you know, this is something that I would definitely pass on to the next generation. Like, you should read this. What would be a few books that you would recommend?
The Alchemist.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a great one. There's a couple too, and I think by the next time we'll talk, I'll be able to like give you like a list of the other ones. But I think that one, just in general, and just again, like sometimes that path to where you're trying to get to, again, like going back to the Lost Boy, I think it ends up being a theme, I think, in my career in general. It's like that road is very winding, but you know, that is sometimes the goal, right? Is to kind of take these different iterations to get all these learnings and insights from taking the unbeaten path, and eventually, you know, that's the journey sometimes is the actual goal, you know what I mean? And just getting a chance to better understand kind of who you are and how these adventures, right, kind of shape the person that you eventually are going to be. So you know, I think again, just having fun, you know what I mean? I think that book in general kind of just showed me, like, you know, do what you can, be happy about what you're doing. There will be setbacks and things too, but again, like, it literally is a journey, which will help you eventually shape the person that you are. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's so important, is to really fall in love with the journey, because you may not like the outcome, right? And so if you don't fall in love with the journey and you don't like the outcome, you feel like your experience and the things that you've gained in that journey is wasted, and it's not.
For sure.
You know, it's really not. Like you said, that job that may be your dream job may not actually be your dream job, but what the person that you became to be, you know, worthy of that dream job is that's the goal, you know, that the person that you have grown to become. So I think that's, you know, that's a great book for the people to read and to sort of think about.
And then any, I think, marketer or someone who's interested in this line of work too, it's a book by Al Rees and Jack Trout, The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. Mm-hmm. It's also a great book just to kind of at least, you know, help understand what exactly that we're doing. And it's a little outdated in the sense that some of the promotional models are talking about, but I think the core of what they're saying and exactly what we're trying to do, it's great insight just to have and kind of just guide, you know, what you're doing from there. And for anyone who's interested in the music industry, I follow this blog, or not just a blog, but a newsletter that comes out every day. It's called The Redefine. It's by Jason Rhee, R-H-E-E. You sign up on his website and you get this, you know, comprehensive daily email, which, you know, he aggregates or, you know, curates with all kinds of articles from, you know, regardless of genres, but about music business in general, right? So you have your cultural pieces and profiles about artists and very particular interesting artists that are happening, conversations around them. But again, the tech side of it, you know, some trends, emerging things that are happening. It's just a great way to kind of just start the morning and understand like what's happening within this, you know, the business of music.
I love it. Man, this has been a great conversation, brother. I really appreciate it. I learned so much, and I'm sure our listeners will learn a lot too. And I hope they got their notebooks out getting these gems, man, or keep hitting rewind, because there's a lot of stuff that I think could be applied to, you know, their internship, their job, and just their life. So I appreciate it, man.
For sure. Anytime.
Thanks for listening. If you like notes from this episode and more, head over to drjaewilliams.com and download Dr. J's Gems. I got notes from all the episodes, helpful resources, and curated content exclusively for my Office Hours fam. Absolutely free. You heard it right. Free. You never know. You just might learn something new. And remember, you are what you've been waiting for. Talk to you soon. Peace.